Man Show. Thank y'all for coming in. And I have today with me Divya Anna Thurami. Did I get it right?
Yeah, you got it.
Awesome. Pronunciations, man, with people names, I get nervous because I don't want to butcher them. But
Divya, I appreciate it.
Like I said, I just don't want to get it wrong, man. Divya from Gotham Taxidermy, all the way up in New York City. Welcome Divya, to the Bryant Land Show. Thank you for stopping in.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat today.
So, what part of New York City are you in?
So, I'm in Brooklyn.
Okay. Spent some time in Brooklyn. Definitely did not see any taxidermy shops when I was there. So like I was telling you before, like I was thumbing, you know, through Instagram and saw like your work and saw like some of your pieces. And, you know, for most of us in the outdoor and hunting community, you know, when we do taxidermy, we think about getting our, you know, our animals, you know, our trophies and stuff, want to have them preserved, displayed, you know, like you look at my background, the wild hog that I shot here in Georgia with my bow, turkeys. I got a couple of geese and ducks off camera. So that's usually what we think about when you think about taxidermy. But looking at your stuff, looking at your business and your page, you do a lot of work with birds. You do a lot of fashion stuff. So I shouldn't say completely, but a little bit out of the box of what we used to. So that's why I wanted to have you on. And just kind of talk about your path to taxidermy and working in the taxidermy industry.
Sure, I'd be, you know, I'm happy to chat about that. I think generally, you know, when people think of New York City, they don't really think of a lot of nature up here. But we do have quite a bit of nature in New York City. You know, everyone thinks of like the skyline. And I mean, right now it's in my window, I'm looking, it's like a bunch of buildings, but also we have a lot of parks. New York City is also on a migratory bird flyway, for lack of like a better, it's not like the sciencey term, but you know, a lot of birds migrate through here. And you can see tons of diversity in birds in the spring and fall during like peak migration. But we also, of course, have urban wildlife. We have the raccoons, we have the possums and squirrels and chipmunks and all of that stuff. So there is like, you know, there is a ton of wildlife in New York City, and we have a ton of coastline as well. So lots of shorebirds, various fish and marine life and stuff like that. So, you know, there is like a lot of people, but also a lot of wild stuff as well. And so for me, I've always grown up in the city and I've always loved animals, and sort of my connection to them came from either like small animals I'd see in a park or something like that, or in like going to a museum and seeing a taxidermy display there, or going to a store or a restaurant where they would have taxidermy more as like a decorative item in some of those places. In a museum, it's more of an educational item. But either way, it was a way that I got close to animals. And when I learned, you know, when you're a little kid, you're like, oh, is that a real animal? What is it? And, you know, as you grow up to an adult, you kind of learn like, oh, someone made that. And that part that someone made that animal, took that animal, sort of like transformed that animal, that they took that animal and turned it into, you know, a representation of itself. That was what was so cool to me. And that part really resonated with me because I thought, what more of an expression of like love and appreciation for an animal? Like what bigger expression of love and appreciation for an animal is there than, you know, recreating it, you know, like turning it into this, you know, this other form of itself. So that's sort of what sparked the interest in taxidermy. And like you said, I, you know, when I grew up, I was always in a big city. So I always thought that taxidermy was only something I could get at an antique store or only something that I'd have to travel outside of the city to get. I never thought it would be a career. So I worked for a long time in the fashion industry and just sort of collected taxidermy on the side, you know, sort of had my little collection. But I also collected books about taxidermy and was initially self-taught in taxidermy. And eventually I started meeting people in the city who are, you know, collectors and artists who use taxidermy in their work and things like that. And then realize that there is actually a community of people in cities who like taxidermy, because listen, a lot of people love animals, a lot of people love nature, and a lot of people like their homes to look, you know, to look a certain way or something. And, you know, taxidermy fulfills a lot of those, you know, a lot of those needs. So, yeah, so a lot of people don't think of like New York City as a place for taxidermy, but I always like to remind people, you know, taxidermy is about art, it's about nature, it combines those things. And so, you know, I think a city is a nice place to have some taxidermy.
So like you were saying, like you grew up in the city. So you grew up in New York City?
No, I grew up in Miami and I've lived in New York for about like close to 20 years. So
Okay. So you, like you say, growing up in the city, you're seeing like different kind of animals and whatnot. You start off in the fashion industry, but you pretty much always had a love and a respect for animals. What was that aha moment like where you're like, you know what? I'm tired of like whatever comes with the fashion industry and stuff. Like, I'm going to do this taxidermy thing. And the fact that you're self-taught to me is even more impressive, because, you know, a lot of people, they go to school or the first question is like, how do I get into taxidermy? So the fact that you're self-taught is completely impressive. But what was that like aha moment? Like, you're just like, all right, you know what? I'm tired of this damn fashion. I'm going to go pursue this taxidermy.
So I started out being self-taught, you know, I learned through books and stuff like that, and experimenting with like roadkill and animals I would find. So that was like the very beginning.
Wait a minute, time up. So, excuse me, experimenting with roadkill. So you're just like,
well, yeah, like experimenting taxidermy, not experimenting like weird experiments.
No.
Trying taxidermy. Roadkill, so.
I got that. So you're just like driving along and you see like a possum or like a raccoon or whatever, or a bird, and just like take it home and just kind of get started on it?
Pretty much. But of course, you know, going with gloves and cooler and stuff like that. And it was never anything really large. You know, it was usually it was squirrels. Like I'd find squirrels, English sparrows. We have a lot of English sparrows and European starlings. So it was learning on things like that. But once I started doing it, you know, I started to look online and look for people who were interested in taxidermy and seeing if any people were either in or near New York City. And I found different taxidermy associations. Like there's a New York one, a New Jersey one, a New England one. And so I started going to those shows and started meeting people who did taxidermy. Now, a lot of the people there at those associations did more of the deer, the ducks, the turkeys, the more traditional, I guess, hunting trophies and hunting memorabilia and memory, you know, those sort of memories that they are preserving. It was more of that world as opposed to me. I was like, well, I want to do these tiny birds and these like really tiny mammals and, you know, work on these things that, I guess like for museums and stuff, they're preserved, but not so much like they weren't done as commonly as for home decor or for, you know, or even within the world of taxidermy. It's more about, you know, it's more about these like larger animals. So, so from those people, I would learn, you know, I learned just about techniques of taxidermy and, you know, seeing how different people do things is really, you know, that's super helpful as well. So going to the associations and going to those shows, they also have seminars and workshops there. So, you know, I think that for me, like the time that I spent in the beginning being self-taught, like taught me what I wanted to do, and then seeing what other people do kind of confirmed what I wanted to do. You know, it was sort of just like, you know, deer are absolutely beautiful creatures. They're so gorgeous. There's so many ways they can look. There's so many little variations. They can have little birthmarks, little like, you know, they change with the seasons. Like it's really cool how many deer there are. But it's not, they don't speak to me the same way as you know, as little birds do, or as like, you know, these smaller animals do that I'm used to seeing around the city, you know, that things that I'm used to sort of looking at. So yeah, that's sort of how it got started. And what really like made the change, to be completely honest, is financially like what made sense. So working in the fashion world, I was working in, you know, at corporate companies. So it was not like, it was a very stable, as like high pressure as that job is, it's very stable. You get a paycheck, you get health insurance, you know, you have these things. Right. Whereas doing taxidermy in a city, it's basically being an independent artist. You know, that's really what you're doing. And since I was very unsure of, you know, there's a community in the city of people who do, you know, who buy taxidermy and appreciate it and all of that, I was still just like, how is this going to be a financially viable job? I'm not independently wealthy. I don't have a family that will just say, yeah, I'll take a year off. It's okay. Like, we can pay your rent or anything like that, you know? And that's a big reality of being an artist or a small business owner. You know, a lot of people money is a dirty topic. No one likes to talk about that, but it's a huge help when you have a cushion. But if you don't have a cushion, you're sort of just like, you're between these two worlds and kind of like working your day job and doing your passion on the side. So you're kind of working like 9 to 5 and then 5 to 9, I guess, or like, you know, how, whatever reality that looks like. Right. So really I was working at my fashion job and doing my taxidermy stuff on nights and weekends, kind of running myself dry, honestly. But the shift happened when there was a small museum locally that was wanting to do taxidermy classes. They wanted someone to teach taxidermy classes specifically on very small mammals and small birds, and sort of, you know, sort of like a one day class, like on something where you can make something small and go home with it. And I started doing classes there once in a while, and then started meeting more people who were interested in taxidermy, started meeting more clients, and started seeing that the demand for these classes was slowly getting bigger and bigger. So I was like, oh, it looks like there is a viable career in this. So it was slowly sort of taking on a few more classes, taking on a few more clients, and kind of gradually it was like, you know, the fashion work was, if we were up here with both fashion and taxidermy work, it was like the fashion work was going down, the taxidermy work was going up, and it was a very gradual shift. I think a lot of times when people make the shift from like the day job to their passion, that you see this sort of like, I just went in one day and quit. It was nothing that romantic or dramatic. It was really gradual because I needed to make sure the rent was paid and that the bills were paid, because there's just no other option for me. So that was really it. So if for people looking to get into taxidermy, I always say, like, you know, find an animal that you're passionate about, or that you really, you know, that you really love, and like, you know, learn on that animal and learn on your own, with the only goal being to just make that animal. Like, just don't have, you know, don't put too much pressure on yourself, because it's a lot of stuff to learn. So.
Yeah, kind of just like take it like one. Almost like one animal at a time, like start with one, kind of see if you like it, make that your project, and then, you know, keep building from that. But no, like what you're saying, as far as like, you know, like just quitting cold turkey and jumping, nose diving into it. No, everybody doesn't have that luxury, if you will, you know, because it does, you know, and money is not a dirty word, because you need it to survive. You need it, you know, to sustain yourself. So like it was smart on your part to just make that gradual transition, because man, let me tell you, like if I could jump directly from my day job into like podcasting like full time, like I would, but you know, I got a kid going away to college, another one right behind him, like that's going to be going to college and responsibilities. Yeah. So it's like you can't always just jump nose dive into your dream, but you can work at it, you know, a little bit at a time, consistently. English is hard. But so the one thing that is, I find really remarkable, and just like looking at your page, is like the birds and then like butterflies. Like you got a piece that I saw on your page where it's like you almost combined like your fashion, your love of fashion, along with the taxidermy. Like it was like a butterfly in a box, like with a Tiffany ring. That I saw, you know what I'm talking about? It's like a little blue butterfly. It was like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
in the Tiffany box or whatnot. So the passion for like birds, butterflies, like smaller animals, but do you, or have you received like requests for some of the larger big game animals, or do you kind of just stay away from them, or like what does that look like for you?
Yeah, so people will ask me, they'll say, oh, I have a deer, can you mount it for me? Or I have, you know, something large that I want mounted. And I'll always refer them to a friend that specializes in that. Because as much as I'm like, you know, I could, yes, I could technically do it. Like, you know, I could technically, you know, mount a deer and do all of that, like do that. But it's one of those things where I'm like, my specialty is these small animals. And there are people who I know, like people in my network, friends of mine, colleagues, where their specialty is these larger animals. So I feel better about saying, hey, like, why don't I give the work to someone in my, you know, in my network who will appreciate it, love it, do it with passion. And, you know, it feels good to help a friend, you know, it feels good to like, to refer work to people who I'm like, you know, I know you'll be super happy with this person. They do big game all the time. So they'll be able to like, get it done faster than I would be able to, you know, because they're always doing it. They're gonna see the details in those animals that I don't see. I mean, if someone was just like very adamant of like, you have to do this, like it needs to be me doing it, then maybe I would, like maybe for like a friend or something, if they were like, oh, I really want you to do it, I would. But even then I'm like, I don't know, like I'm, my specialty is something different. So there's that.
Nice. Yeah. Dude, so being a bird, or specializing in the birds or the smaller animals, like you said, like do you get requests from like the duck hunters and like you know, geese and waterfowlers and stuff, or is it more, because like I was looking at your page and I saw you got some really high-end clients, like you've done stuff for the Audubon Society, you've done, you know, like a lot of museums and stuff like that. So you have like a really, like a lot of high end clients, but do you get like the waterfowlers and stuff like you, down there in Brooklyn?
Sometimes it's not a lot of them. And I think what happens is like, you know, if someone goes hunting, they're not hunting, you know, you're not hunting in Brooklyn. You know, you're not within the city. So yep. I think a lot of times they're going with someone who's closer to the place where they hunted. But I do have, I do get a couple people who will bring, you know, who will bring the birds back and say, hey, I want you to do this. So I do get a couple people, but not a lot. And then also, there are also a lot of people too, who think because I'm very much like a city person, there are also people who are like, oh, I don't know if you like hunting, or I don't know if you're anti-hunting, which is not the case at all. I think most people who grow up in a city don't have the right perception of what hunting is. They think it's going out and blowing the heads off of someone in a very rude way. I think, you know, I'm just like, you know, I'm a person from a city, you know, like I've gone with hunters of color to their workshops and stuff, and it's been extremely educational, but I wish more people in the city could do stuff like that. And I really admire the work that groups like Hunters of Color are doing. I really admire like your podcast, bringing hunting to anyone who has earbuds and an internet connection. Like I think it's really, really cool. But I think a lot of times like hunters in the city are hesitant to be kind of like out as hunters because of all the misconceptions around, you know, it feels even weird calling it a sport of hunting. I feel like it's like an act. It's like a whole ritual of hunting. So yeah. I think a lot of times because of the misconceptions, a lot of hunters in the city might not want to be like, hey, I'm a hunter, you know, yeah. And they might assume, talk a lot about
a lot of folks, like, I mean, I do consider it a sport, and then but when you say it's a sport, yeah, and some people like they get upset with that, it's like, oh, it's a blood sport and all this other stuff, like people get upset. But I mean, like, at the core, you know, for some people it is a ritual, like they're very connected, you know, to like the animals and connected to the earth and the environment. Like it is a spiritual activity for them. And it's funny because like I talked to Rue Mapp last year, and then a couple other people that I've talked to, and I always joke, like for folks out west, I always feel like they get more into the spiritualness of it, and you know, it's like the animals and connecting one with the earth and stuff, where here's like down south, we're like, we're going hunting, we're gonna get some deer, we're gonna get deer meat, we're gonna, you know, put it on the grill, we're gonna get these birds, these ducks, wrap them in bacon, like, you know, like we're all about like the food and the experience. But for you, like, And I know you said you've done some work with Hunters of Color. I've talked to them as well. They do great. They do a great job as well as promoting people of color and African Americans and other people of color in the hunting industry. But are you, do you consider yourself like an outdoorsy kind of girl? Like, have you gone out? Like, have you done been on hunts and stuff before? Either like yourself or whatever, like.
Yeah, I've not been on hunts and stuff by myself. I've gone fishing myself. I've gone, of course, lots of birding myself. I've gone hiking. I do a lot of stuff outside. It's funny because like when I think of it, I'm like, am I outdoorsy? And I'm like, oh yeah, I go outside like every, you know, all the time. It might not look like something epic, you know, it might not look like a, you know, like a 4-day hike going up, climbing a mountain or something like that. But pretty much every weekend I'm, you know, I'm outside somewhere looking at some animal, looking at some birds probably, honestly, but, you know, doing something outdoors. And I, you know, I really love, you know, I love being outside, especially when, you know, I mean, right now it's summer, it's kind of hot, but I like the heat, so it's okay, but it's too hot. But yeah. But yeah, I would say I'm outdoorsy, maybe not in someone's like, you know, someone who lives somewhere with like access to like a big forest or like, you know, something much larger than what we have in New York City, they might not consider it the same, but I think at the root of it, it's the same. You're going outside, you're appreciating nature, whether that nature is, you know, a little sparrow or a big deer or, you know, an alligator, whatever, something out there, you're appreciating it. That's really what it's all about, you know?
Exactly. Getting outdoors, appreciate it, being outside, making the most of it. That is what it's all about. Like, deer season is pretty much right around the corner down here. And as much as I love going, you know, deer hunting and, you know, the chess match of trying to, you know, beat a deer and its nose and, you know, its senses and its eyes and stuff, there's something about sitting outside or either sitting in the stand or sitting in a blind when it's dark and then being able to see like the sunrise or being out there in the afternoon or in the evenings and, you know, watching the sun set, you know, being out there in the morning and watching the forest come alive. Like, you know, it's dark, it's quiet once you get settled in, but then as the sun starts coming up, the birds start chirping, animals start moving around, like just watching the woods come alive. I mean, there is a lot to be said about that. So that's a lot of the outdoor experience as well. With the pieces that you've done, because I noticed too, again, you know, we think about the trophies and then, you know, birds and nature and stuff like that, but I saw you also do like pet preservation, like where you do like stuff for people that have pets and stuff. How much of that is your business?
I would say that's like a pretty, I would say it's a, not a huge part of my business, but it's definitely a sizable part of it. You know, because I'm in the city a lot, you know, a lot of people do have pets here. That's what a lot of people's connection to animals is, through their pets first. Sometimes people are, you know, they don't really think of themselves as animal people, but then I'll say like, well, you have this pet, you care for this pet, you know its needs and all of this stuff. So that's their intro to connecting with animals. So yeah, I'd say it's like, it's definitely a significant part, but not like, I think that birds are more of like, you know, are a bigger part of my like day-to-day work. With pets, most of it is not like, I do people's pet birds, a lot of pet birds I get. But a lot of the pet work I do ends up being something like paw prints or casts or, you know, like making a little display with like fur or something like that, where it's not full on the pet, because, you know, animals are all different, you know, and pets especially. Like I have cats and I have some pet birds too. But I know what my pets look like, and I've spent, you know, decades with them, and, you know, pets can live very long. They can live, you know, a cat can live anywhere from like, you know, 12, so sometimes even 20 years, you know, they can live for a very long time. Right. pet birds live to be, you know, sometimes pet birds outlive their owners even. So there's so much like personal connection you have with a pet that like, as much as I might know anatomy, as much as I might like study photos and videos and everything, it's still, you know, I still didn't spend all that personal time. So with pets, it tends to be limited. I kind of almost talk people out of it because like, I want them to have, you know, the right expectations to know that, you know, I can do a lot, but I can't replace what that relationship you might've had. And like, there are certain quirks and nuances that you'll know with your pet that I won't ever know because I didn't live with that. You know, I didn't have that relationship. I didn't live with that animal for as long as you did. And so, you know, and so like setting those expectations and having that conversation up front is very important with pet preservation. And usually that tends to make people go with something that's not so much like, you know, the physical, like the complete physical replication of their pet. They end up going with some sort of memento or something instead.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what was the like strangest or like weirdest like request or like pet that you've had? Cause like some people they'll keep like, again, knowing that your specialty is, you know, like birds and smaller animals, but you know, I guess people may not necessarily know that when they first, you know, reach out to you, you know, for like a project or something like that. So what's like the weirdest like request or like animal or whatever that a person had as a pet and they wanted you to like preserve it or do something with it?
I would say it probably wasn't a pet, but I've definitely had I have a client that gets a lot of farm animals. And the farm animals he gets were born with deformities. You know, the most recent project I did for him was it was a small goat that was born with two heads and eight legs. And it was like really, you know, it wasn't viable. So it didn't live long past birth. But he is a collector of these sorts of animals where they're, you know, they have all these anomalies and these like, you know, these physical abnormalities. So working on something like that, even though it's not a bird, it's something where I was like, well, this is a challenge. This is something really interesting. That was definitely an interesting project to work on. And yeah, I would say things like that are very much, probably like strange requests, but also very challenging because it defies everything you learn when you think of, you know, when you read books about anatomy and you read books about art, they're all about symmetry or it's all about like, oh, things should be, you know, things go here. In anatomy, there's certain symmetry to the body, and in art, there's certain symmetry and ratio that is just pleasing to the eye, you know. But when you have something that was born that defies all of those rules, you're sort of like, okay, well, how do I approach this? So that was, yeah, I would say that one was really, really
cool. Wow. So was it like a full body piece? Like you did like the full body with the two heads and the eight legs? Like it was almost like a Siamese twin kind of thing? It was all joined together?
Yeah. It was, it was really interesting. And so I have it, I think I posted it like earlier this year. So I had it and he wanted it done sort of like, so he wanted the, you know, the animal preserve, but he also wanted it in this, sort of this like setting of like grass with flowers looking like a little springtime meadow, you know, like a springtime clearing in a meadow or something. So that was really interesting because there was like the scientific aspect of it, but then presenting it in this very like soft and gentle way, as opposed to presenting it like, oh, like a freak show or something, you know, like. Because oftentimes animals can be presented in like, oh, look at how weird it is. It's sort of like, well, this animal's pretty weird, but also like, it's still an animal. Like, you know, this is a way to I guess, appreciate and kind of learn from it after its passing.
Right. Would you say that was the most complex thing that you've done in your career?
Honestly, I would say it's one of the more complex things. Because not just because of the animal itself, but it was also preserved in formalin for a little bit, and so that made the skin really tough. And so there were other issues with like removing the formalin to tan the skin and stuff like that. So I would say it was definitely challenging. But I think I think some of the most challenging things I work on are birds, because, you know, something like a woodcock or a mourning dove, like their skin is so thin, you know, and people do hunt them, and, you know, museums do have them mounted for their displays as well. But my goodness, like when you see, like I did a woodcock, I did a couple of woodcocks earlier this year, and, you know, working on them, I love seeing them. They're such funny little birds, and they're like little, I don't know, they make a funny sound, like everything about them. I'm like, you're like a Pokemon, like come to life. But they're just like, they're so cool. But when you see them on the inside, you're like, oh my gosh, your skin is so thin. Like, how do you, you know, it's almost a miracle you're alive. You know, your skin is so thin. Like, there's so much like fat on it. Like when you try and peel the fat off, it just, the skin can sometimes just fall apart. You're like, wow, this is amazing that these are the ingredients to your anatomy, and these are sort of the ingredients to your life. Like, how is this, you know, it kind of makes you really appreciate that animal even more.
Wow. That is awesome. Like I said, I would have never like really thought about like doing a lot of work, like with the smaller birds, the butterflies. Like I even seen like you've done like work with like bats. Like how did that come about?
So bats, the bats I've done were for a museum. So most bats are, in the U.S. at least, most bats are protected. A lot of stores will sell bats. Like if you go to like an antiques or oddities store, like sometimes they'll be selling bats. But a lot of those were imported from overseas, and they're not really taxidermy. They're sort of like mummified or freeze-dried. But it's like a gray area ethically, because it's like, you don't know, like if that was a regulated harvest, you don't know from the preservation side, if it's just mummified or freeze-dried, you're just sort of like,
poached, okay, like, or it's something just, like that.
Yeah, it's not really fully preserved. You know, it's not really like, you don't know how it was preserved. Basically, it's like, if you don't know how it was preserved, you don't know how the animal was harvested, and you don't know the conditions of like the person doing any of these things. Like, to me, I'm sort of like, I'd rather avoid it. So a lot of like what's sold in the U.S. is bat taxidermy is really not taxidermy. It's big dry, you know, it's like a dried bat. The bats I did, I was really excited about, because I was like, it's such a rare opportunity to work on a bat. But it was for a museum, and they wanted a bat in a flying pose for their, I didn't get to do much of the diorama or anything. They already had a display. But yeah, it was a bat flying in a display. And I also made, because I worked on that bat, I was like, well, I'm going to also make this an opportunity to take measurements from this bat and get as much info as possible so I can make replica bats. And I've done a lot of replica bats, which were, I think, might be the one you're talking about. It's like in a big dome, with like flowers and stuff like that. So those are replica. So those aren't made of real bat at all. And there are people who also 3D print bat skeletons, which I've used those and built, used like sculpting materials and fur and stuff to build bats on top of that. So you can get your taxidermy replica bat from that as opposed to the real one.
Gotcha. So what, I guess for you, what is the, like, what's your next steps, and then like your ultimate goal? Like, what's the next like big thing that you want to do or you want to accomplish, or like, or are you at a good place with your business and just doing the taxidermy and stuff that you're doing? Like, what does the future hold, or what does Divya want to do in her future?
So I think, I mean, career-wise, I think things are going pretty great for me now. I like, you know, I like what I'm doing. I think I do want to take, I kind of do want to find a way to make more of the art projects I want to do, because a lot of, you know, most of what I do is client work. I'd say almost all of what I do right now is client work. I don't really do much in the way of making a piece and selling it. I haven't done much like, you know, artwork or even just making a piece for myself, thinking about that. So I kind of want to make more time for doing that, just, you know, completely personal, whatever, but still something I want to do. The other thing that's been really a goal of mine since I started, you know, since my business started picking up and since I started getting, you know, regular work, is I want to do more education and outreach and bringing more people and especially more diversity into this field, because taxidermy is very not diverse. It's like the opposite of diverse, which is exactly. homogenous. So, and there are lots of barriers, you know, for people to learn it. Like some people, you know, for me, I'm in New York City, so I'm insulated by all this other diversity in the city. I'm always just like, well, I can always go back to the city. I'm always like, well, I can always find, you know, I've got like, I'm fortunate being here. It's a huge place of privilege being a place of being and living in a place like New York City, you know, but you know, there are people who don't live here and might want to be getting into taxidermy, and they might be the only person of color in their, you know, in their whole neighborhood. And they're like, I'm afraid of going to this taxidermy association. I don't know if they'll, you know, I don't know if they'll accept me. I don't know if there's a space for me there. I don't, you know, so I kind of want to make, you know, I kind of want to make taxidermy just more like accessible to people, whether they're learning it online or, you know, or from me at a class, and being able to go back and like share it with people so that they have their own space. You know, like in the city, I'm like, I have a space where people can come and I won't judge them, and if they want whatever they want to learn, that's small. You know, granted, I only do little things, but, you know, I feel like just enabling people to make their own spaces so that they're able to share, you know, taxidermy specifically, but, you know, outdoor stuff or anything, you know, kind of working with like-minded folks in that way is, you know, it's, I think that's an ongoing thing, like an ongoing goal and an ongoing, you know, mission, because, you know, with taxidermy, I'm around death all the time, and I'm always thinking of what I'm going to leave behind, you know, aside from all of these animals. I want there to be more people doing this work, you know, more people like us, you know, more people like you, more people like me, like seeing themselves in the outdoors, in nature, in where the outdoors and nature and art combine. And, you know, I think that is, you know, that's really important.
Well, you're definitely on your way leaving a great legacy behind. Like I saw on your website, like where you're doing classes, people can like come to you and learn. Do you have an apprentice yet?
I don't have an apprentice. No, I'm at the, so right now I'm sort of like, because of how slammed I am with work, I don't know if I'm able to really train someone one-on-one to be with me every day. Sure. But I do offer people to just, you know, if they want to video chat me, or if they want to like show a project to me while they're doing it, you can, you know, we can work like for an hour or two, you know, virtually, or if they're in New York City, we can schedule time to come by, and being able to, you know, being able to do that. Like I'm always open for that, but I don't know if I can take someone in being like, all right, every single day we're gonna do this, you know, we're gonna do this. Just because of, yeah, again, if there were more hours in the day, I would love it, but there's, at this point, no, but I'm always open to helping people. So if people are out there listening and need help with a project, or just need someone to talk to about getting into taxidermy, I'm always here for that.
Awesome, absolutely. next time, I come through New York for work, I definitely have to see if you're not busy. I would love to come by and just check out your studio and check out like your artwork like up close, because like I said, just looking at it on Instagram, like it's extremely impressive, especially for somebody like me who wouldn't know how to begin to do anything taxidermy wise. I mean, just looking at like the collages you've done, like flamingos, like you got all kind of stuff that is just out of the box. And I think it's really cool. So kudos to you. Where can people find your artwork? Where can they find like all your taxidermy pieces and get in touch with you if they need something done or want to learn? Like let folks know how they can get in contact with you.
Sure. So you can find me on my website, GothamTaxidermy.com. My contact info is there and all of that. And I'm also on social media. I'm probably most active on Instagram, which is Gotham Taxidermy. I have TikTok too, but I keep getting account warnings on there because people are like seeing, they report my stuff for gore and violence. So
I'm okay. Kind of like, I was like, what are you doing on TikTok that you can report it? Like what?
Yeah, a lot of people report for gore and violence, which is pretty sad because this is not gory or violent at all. But anyway, I am on TikTok too. Maybe like some of my stuff there, so maybe it'll make the people who are reporting like suppress them a little bit. I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, it's Gotham for me there as well. So yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Divya, again, I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you for coming through and sharing this with us. And hopefully we'll chat soon.
Yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, if you're in New York, definitely let me know. I'll make time. So yeah.
Awesome.